Hello and welcome to Pandora's Box. This is Kalia. And today is part 9 from self-loathing to self-loving. As we work on loving ourselves on deeper and deeper levels, we must consider our self-image. Our self-image is the idea we have about who we are. And we form these ideas from how we perceive ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Our body image is a major part of our self-image because it's our physical form that we see when we look into the mirror, and our physical form that we present to others. If we're unsatisfied with our physical presentation, it greatly affects our self-esteem. The deeper truth is the way we perceive ourselves physically comes directly with how we feel about ourselves on the inside. When we close our eyes and drop inside of ourselves, we have a feeling that is either peaceful or chaotic. We either like the way we feel or we don't. That inside feeling is projected upon our physical appearance and influences how we perceive ourselves physically. We can be the most physically beautiful person, but if we feel bad about ourselves on the inside, we'll not be able to perceive our own beauty. Inner beauty radiates outward. So how we feel about ourselves on the inside has a powerful impact on how we perceive our physical appearance. Of course, when you have strong addictions like food, which contributes to being very overweight, it will affect not only how you feel on the inside, but how you look on the outside. Often it is our inner chaos and pain that contributes to our addictive personalities that cause us to overeat as an emotional outlet or to drink excessively or turn to drugs or any kind of addictive behavior, including being involved in abusive relationships. Any kind of addictive behavior is self-abuse. And it's impossible to really feel good about yourself when you're engaged in self-abusive behavior. One of the most important paths to recovery from addiction is to confront our emotional pain and feelings of disconnection we have from ourselves and others. Addiction is a way to escape from one's current experience of reality. In order to heal from addiction, one must face or confront that which he or she is trying to escape. Addiction is a distraction. What are you distracting yourself from? Are you overeating, overworking, drinking too much, turning to drugs? What are you seeking relief from? What are you really trying to escape or get away from? Most often, it is the way that you feel inside. Making friends with one's feeling reality is an important part of learning to love oneself. You don't have to like how you feel in any given moment. We all have a variety of feeling states. We don't always feel good. If you believe you should always feel good, you're not being very realistic. Life is cyclical. You'll have times where you feel great and other times you feel terrible, and this is life. You can learn how to feel great more often by how you view life and yourself. But you can also learn to embrace all your feeling states and stop judging them as good or bad. For example, it's normal to feel sad when you break off a relationship or when someone you love passes away. Sometimes we even feel sad for no apparent reason. But what do you do with the sadness? Do you see it as a sign that something is wrong with you? Or can you see your sadness as an emotional phase that you are passing through? It's typical one will go into self-loathing when one feels dark emotions and be more in self-loving when he or she feels good. The key to living a life that is much more loving and affirmative to the self is to learn to love yourself in all of your emotional states. If you see a child suffering emotional pain, would you withdraw your love and affection? Of course not. You would most likely want to give that child more attention, love, and affection to soothe his or her pain. You must learn to do the same with your own inner child. Your inner child or feeling self deserves to be loved and embraced, regardless of what your inner emotional states are at the time. It's no different than your own physical child deserving to be loved regardless of the mood that you are in. The more loving you can be towards yourself, the more you can embrace yourself regardless of your current emotional state. The more accepting you will be of yourself, and the more you will see your own beauty. Beauty, they say, is only skin deep. Well, this is a common saying for those who place the focus on how one's physical appearance is. This saying is really capturing the idea that how one looks on the outside has very little to do with who he or she is on the inside. True beauty and depth comes from within. The more beautiful one is within, the more that inner beauty radiates outward and is attractive, magnetic energy that draws others in. The beauty industry is a multi-billion dollar industry because there's a cultural belief that if we appear beautiful on the outside, we'll get all the love we want. And this is completely untrue. There are many physically beautiful people who are very depressed, unhappy, and unfulfilled in love. Beautiful women get their hearts broken just as often, if not more so, than women who might be considered more plain by society standards. In fact, women who have less focus on physical beauty are more often much happier and fulfilled in their relationships than women who are obsessed with their physical appearance. Although it makes sense that we would want to take good care of ourselves physically and that our weight is a healthy, desirable weight for our body frame, obsessing about our physical appearance puts our energy and attention on the external rather than the internal. An internal focus will produce the greatest results in achieving a happy and fulfilling life. True self-love is the key to happiness. All love is a reflection of self-love. The more you learn to love yourself, the more you can receive and accept love from the outside. The more you can let it in. The more you love yourself, the more you can also extend that love to others. All love that does not have its roots in self-love is superficial. It may be codependent. It may be lust. It may be ego-driven. And this is why it's said, if you don't love yourself, you can't truly love another. If we don't come from self-love, the true ability to care about and value ourselves, then the love we give another is usually out of an attempt to please, to get approval, to prove ourselves, or get some need met. So let's look at false confidence versus true confidence. Just as false love comes from a desire to get a need met, false confidence is derived from extracting outside validation, approval, and recognition. We may believe we're confident because we get positive feedback on our appearance, our sexiness, our performance in work or art or any other area, or just validation that we're a great person. But all it takes is a narcissist or someone to come along who invalidates everything about us, finds fault with us, blames us, and criticizes us, and our confidence slowly or even quickly disintegrates. I see this all the time with my clients who've been involved with narcissists, and I've gone through this myself. Fear has been described as false evidence appearing real. We go into fear when we're unsure of who we really are. If we believe we are what others tell us we are, our level of confidence will be based on how we are perceived by others. We become afraid that the way others see us is real or true, especially when it's negative and unflattering. However, when we learn to understand that our own self-perception is the only perception we should ever truly align with, we gain power back over our inner confidence, especially when we learn to see ourselves as good, as lovable, as caring, as thoughtful, as talented, as beautiful, and all the things we discover about ourselves through the positive reflection of others as it bounces off our own self-understanding. It's not that we don't need others. We're social creatures, and we do need the mirrors of those around us. When we can form a positive self-opinion, we learn to choose our mirrors wisely. The lower one's level of conscious awareness, the more one will project his or her self-loathing and negative self-image onto those who dare come close. When we can truly understand this dynamic, we stop taking the critics and fault finders so personally. The one thing I've learned through my work with narcissistic abuse is that almost all narcissists project their inner reality onto their loved ones. This is how they maintain their illusion of superiority. If a narcissist feels inferior deep down, he will project his inferiority onto people who are closest to him and pump himself up to an inflated belief in his own superiority. If you are someone who puts a lot of weight on how others perceive you, it will deflate your self-esteem to be with a narcissist because he or she will elevate his or her own worth and deflate yours. And this is the nature of the beast. Although a narcissist will often say in the beginning, "I finally met my match," or "I have an equal in you," this is usually short-lived because when he or she starts to feel that you might actually be better in some way, your value has to be diminished to compensate for his or her feelings of inferiority. If you earn more money, you may be told that you are selfish for not giving it away or sharing it more readily, even if you share everything that you have. If you're physically beautiful and getting a lot of attention and admiration for your beauty out in the world, the narcissist will likely start making subtle comments about how you really aren't all that good looking. If you're successful in your career, you may be told that all you care about is your career, and you may even be challenged to give it up to show your love. In our quest to master our own life and be confident in ourselves, we have to really learn how the insecurities of others can easily be transferred to us through subtle actions, comments, and put-downs. It's important to learn that when you don't like the way somebody talks to you, it's wise to put distance between that person and yourself. The problem most people have with this is they want to remain objective and consider what others have to say about them. One might think, if I separate myself from everyone who offers me constructive criticism, I'm no better than the narcissist. Well, you have to learn the difference between constructive criticism and critical personality. Can the person who offers constructive criticism also take it? Or is there a double standard? If there is a double standard, if one can dish it out but not take it, you have a fragile narcissistic personality who gets power from criticizing others but cannot receive any input about his or her own personality. And any relationship like this is unbalanced and not healthy. There are ways we can offer constructive feedback to others that is kind, caring, and focused on one's positive qualities. There's a way to communicate how we feel about something someone says to us without being defensive or attacking. Learning nonviolent communication is important on the path to greater self-awareness and greater relationships with others. There's a website out there called the Center for Nonviolent Communication, and this is what they say. Nonviolent communication is based on the principles of nonviolence, the natural state of compassion when no violence is present in the heart. Nonviolent communication begins by assuming that we are all compassionate by nature and that violent strategies, whether verbal or physical, are learned behaviors taught and supported by the prevailing culture. Nonviolent communication also assumes that we share the same basic human needs and that each of our actions are a strategy to meet one or more of these needs. People who practice nonviolent communication have found greater authenticity in their communication, increased understanding, deepening connection, and conflict resolution. Nonviolent communication is an excellent practice in communicating with others. However, certain individuals will not respond favorably to such a communication style. We cannot assume that because the style of communication is superior to most styles, that fragile personalities will be able to hear us, have compassion for us, and care about what we have to say. The very nature of narcissism is an inability to consider the other. It's all about me. It's all about my feelings, my needs, and my desires, and yours are not important. And this is why most information on NPD, or narcissistic personality, discourages you from trying to make it work with a personality like this. It's most often a losing battle. Instead of trying to communicate with someone who cannot consider you or hear you, why not find the people who are truly open to positive styles of communication and can truly embrace all of who you are? Who we choose to surround ourselves with makes a huge difference in how we feel about ourselves. It's an act of self-love to choose our companions wisely. We choose people who treat us with consideration and respect. And this is a result of treating ourselves with consideration and respect. If your self-image is such that you feel unworthy of positive treatment, it's important to ask yourself where this comes from. When did you first learn that you were not worthy? Where did this message come from? Where did you first get the idea that you were ugly or fat or stupid or undesirable? What were the circumstances? Looking back, you might be able to see that these messages were a product of projection from someone in your life who didn't feel so good about himself or herself and so needed to find fault with you. Remember, the description of nonviolent communication says, "We are all compassionate by nature, and that violent strategies, whether verbal or physical, are learned behaviors taught and supported by the prevailing culture. Core shame passed down from generation to generation comes from these violent strategies that our parents learned from their parents who learned from their parents and so on. If we don't learn to heal this within ourselves, we pass it on to our children and they will pass it on to their children. Of course, it isn't always a parent, but sometimes a teacher or a culture itself that passes down shaming behavior. We can heal our core shame by assuming that this is a false belief we have learned about ourselves. False evidence appearing real. It's not that we are really unworthy, shameful, or flawed to the core. There's simply a belief that says we are, and we have aligned with that belief. Whenever we try and break out of that belief, something pulls us back into it. If we have low self-worth, we're much easier to control, and so it is to the advantage of controlling people to feed our negative self-perceptions. If you consider that a negative self-image is simply learned behavior or a false belief, you have learned about yourself, you can work to eliminate that fear and instead of fault finding, start fact finding. I'm sure that you can find plenty of facts that will validate your true beauty and worthiness. If you can't find any facts, then ask someone who you really trust to give you some positive feedback about yourself. You may learn you are kind-hearted, caring, loving, smart, talented, and ambitious. A popular exercise in self-awareness is to ask those closest to you for their feedback about how they perceive you. If you have 10 people tell you that you are kind, caring, loving, smart, talented, and beautiful, and one person says, well, you're cruel, uncaring, unloving, stupid, and ugly, who are you going to believe? Of course, the narcissist in your life doesn't want you to see your value in a positive light because he or she will lose control. If the narcissist has you believing there's something really wrong with you, it gives the narcissist more power and control. If you believe you're beautiful, loving, caring, and smart, the narcissist knows if he or she continues to be his or her narcissistic self, you're not going to stick around. Why would you stay with someone who is always fault-finding with you and if you had confidence in yourself? So let's talk about body image for a moment. Finding fault with our body image is a cultural norm. There are such high standards of perfection put upon us in our society that we are constantly being held up against. The media and our advertising agencies bombard us with subliminal messages that say, if you look like this, you can have that. What we're often told through these messages is, you're not good enough as you are. You need to use this product, or take this class, or buy this car, and you will have sex, love, and admiration. These are subconscious messages we're constantly receiving, and we don't even realize most of the time how deeply ingrained they are. We so often fear that if we don't measure up to the standards set by society, we'll be rejected and unloved. So if we put on a few extra pounds, or we have a skin condition, or our body isn't a model's body, we may have the belief we simply don't measure up. Anorexia and bulimia are relatively young diseases. It emerged from a need to be perfect and fear of being out of control in one's life. If we go back 200 years, a plumped, round woman was considered beautiful, and a slender woman was more a symbol of poverty. The more curves, the better, and it wasn't about breasts. The wealthy woman was fed well and had a voluptuous figure. She filled out her clothes nicely. The skinny woman was undernourished and looked like a bag of bones in her gunny sack clothing. The skinny woman didn't become the desired body image until the advertising agencies started using skinny women in their clothing catalogs because they wanted the clothing to get the attention, not the women. This is clear evidence that we judge ourselves according to what is the cultural norm at the time. Now that same woman who was once considered voluptuous and beautiful is considered a plus size, and there's pressure put on her to slim down. Of course, if we look at the standards enforced upon us by society, out of the picture, most people just want to be healthy. We want to be slender enough to be actively engaged in life and do the activities we enjoy. It's ironic how now the pressure put on women is to have large breasts, to wear breast augmentations is common amongst so many women. The statistics are that breast enlargement is the second most common cosmetic surgical procedure practiced on women in the United States. It increased by 306% between 1992 and 1998. According to the American Society of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgeons, more than 125,000 breast augmentation procedures are performed each year. Presently, more than 2 million, or approximately 8% of women in the United States, have breast implants. The majority of breast implant recipients are Caucasian women, and that's 95% of the breast implant recipients in the United States are Caucasian women, followed by African-American women, which is only 4%, and the remaining women that have breast implants are Asian, which is 0.5%, and other non-specific races, also 0.5%. So I feel that these stats suggest that Caucasian-American women feel the greatest pressure to receive or to achieve some kind of ideal. Another irony is that a study done with American men asking what body type they most liked in women, large breasts didn't even factor very high. In fact, the healthy, athletic body type was found much more appealing by the average man. Men tended to be more attracted to shiny hair, a healthy body, clear complexion, and clear eyes, which are all signs of health. By nature, men are attracted to healthy bodies because healthy women can bear healthy children, which is what we carry forward genetically. Any woman can breastfeed her children regardless of the size of her breast. In fact, women's breast sizes increase when she's pregnant to support her milk supply. Of course, there were a small percentage of men who said they were definitely a boob man. This was actually the minority, not the majority. So why are so many women getting breast implants? Who are they getting them for? Good question. In another survey, married men often support their wives in getting breast implants, not because they want them, but because it's what the woman wants in order to feel sexier. The man could actually care less. So once again, the women who get breast implants are doing so because they believe it will give them greater sex appeal, when the men who love them would love them no more as a result. Another irony is that when women have a breast augmentation, they usually lose feeling in their breasts, which contributes to their feeling less, not more. And when a woman trades in a superficial appearance for actual sensation during sex, it really gives a clear message on how she views herself. Of course, some of the stats include women who have had breast cancer and desire reconstructive surgery to feel normal after a mastectomy, and this is a whole different story. Of course, having breast surgery is a personal choice, and I can't judge a woman who chooses this route. I've had friends who have had the surgery and say it's the best thing they ever did. They simply feel sexier. But the stats will tell you that a woman with bigger boobs does not have a happier, more fulfilling sex life than a small-breasted woman, and she's not more likely to attract a healthy, happy relationship. On the contrary, a woman who puts herself forth superficially will be more likely to attract a superficial man. If as a woman you go for the big boob look and attract the 10 or 20% of boob men out there, you need to understand that a boob man will always be looking at boobs, yours and every other woman's. Men have their own challenges in appearance, so I've been really addressing women's issues. However, for men, it seems that financial and material success makes a man more desirable than physical appearance. By nature, women, and this is once again the inherited genealogy, by nature, women are looking for a good provider. And it's not that women can't provide for themselves these days, but our biology is very ancient. And if we travel back in time, even just a few hundred years ago, the man was the provider and the woman the child bearer and the nurturer. The biological urges are the same, even though circumstances and roles have changed. So for men, the pressure is more to be successful financially, materially. One of the most attractive features that attract a man to a woman is confidence. Confidence has the greatest sex appeal. There are some older statistics that will have women believing that if she's needy, she'll be more desirable to a man. There's a belief that strong, confident women are a threat to men, and this is not necessarily true. It may be true for more insecure men, but not to the average man of the new millennium. In a recent survey of what men found most desirable in a woman, confidence topped the list. What we often misinterpret is that a man likes to feel needed and useful in a woman's life, and if a woman makes a man feel he's not needed in her life and it is insignificant, he may go elsewhere. Sometimes successful women have learned to do it all by themselves and won't really allow a man to do for them. And this is why strong women often get a bad rap. We sometimes do this unconsciously. We don't want to feel that we're taking advantage of a man, so we whip out our credit cards to pay for dinner, or we don't ask him to help us fix a leaky faucet or drive us to the airport. And if women understand the nature of a man, not a narcissistic man, but a healthier so-called normal man, we would focus more on being healthy and allowing ourselves to be nurtured and supported by a man, not not financially, but in other ways. On the flip side, women also find a confident man most appealing. Confidence outshines physical appearance. The reason narcissistic men are so appealing is that they exude a false sense of confidence, which is mistaken for true confidence. Confidence is not a belief that one can do no wrong, which you find in the narcissist. It's more a belief that one is worthy, capable, and can achieve anything he puts his mind to. The best thing any of us can do to attract a strong mate, if that is what you are trying to do, is to develop our confidence in ourselves. Confidence overrides body image. You can be a round, voluptuous woman with confidence standing next to a woman with an ideal body type by today's standards, but who has no self-confidence, and the woman with confidence will outshine. Confidence in ourselves makes us shine brightly, and it's truly our radiant light that is our most attractive quality. The other stuff is just packaging. The deeper truth is that in any relationship, sooner or later the wrapper will come off, and we get to see who's really inside. It's what's inside the package that matters most, because that's what influences how we feel. So if you're 100 pounds overweight, strive to lose weight for health reasons so that you can feel comfortable in your body. If you're growing older and losing confidence in yourself because you're no longer young, focus on getting healthy. Change your diet, work out, become youthful in your attitude and in your outlook on life. This will take you much further than a facelift. What we all really want is to feel good on the inside. We want to feel good with our mates. We want to feel loved, accepted, valued, appreciated, and admired by our mates. How old, young, fat, skinny we are has nothing to do with how we feel when we're with someone. If you feel inadequate, you will project your feelings of inadequacy onto your mate and will not trust that he or she really loves you or cares about you, or you will attract someone who really is incapable of loving you or caring about you. How you feel about yourself has everything to do with how you will feel in a relationship with another. Sooner or later, the deeper truth emerges. What is that deeper truth when it comes to your relationship with yourself? This is a really important question to ask yourself. Your self-image is how you perceive yourself, the image you hold in your mind about who you are. If you truly learn to love yourself, your self-image will reflect that love, and you'll feel good about who you are. This will give you the confidence you need to go out into the world and radiate the light that you are, attracting that which you truly desire into your life. If you are looking to increase your confidence, if you are looking to do some work on yourself and you really need some help and support, please contact me through my websites, pathbacktoself.com or narcissismfree.com, where I offer counseling and hypnotherapy for personal growth and for healing from narcissistic abuse. You can also find several books and audio programs for download. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.